I'm going to go back to explaining the various events in the thermal history that I put on the board last time. Just as another general comment, the events that I wrote up can all be classified into three types. There are annihilation events, where some particles annihilate, like E plus U minus annihilation, when the temperature of the universe is around 0.5 MeV, electron mass. And that's the only one we really need to talk about in much detail. Or muon annihilation, which happens at around 100 MeV. There are so-called decoupling events. By the way, freeze-out is also a synonym for decoupling. So you have some species that stops interacting with the plasma below some temperature, that freezes out of the plasma. And I'll talk today about neutrino decoupling, which happens at around 1 MeV. If there's time, I'll get to dark matter decoupling. And then there's what I'll call binding events, which are just when a bound state starts to become thermodynamically favored over free particles. For example, recombination of protons and electrons into neutral hydrogen, which happens at around 0.3 EV. And Big Bang nucleosynthesis is also an example where neutrons and protons bind to form helium at a temperature of around 0.1 MeV. I won't get to these today. So last time we built up a pretty systematic understanding of the first type of event, annihilation events. And that understanding is captured pretty well by this picture. Here's a plot of versus temperature with high temperatures on the left. So I'll put like 100 GeV over here and 0.5 MeV down here. And then on the y-axis, I'll plot the energy density of the universe, or rather its normalized version G star, is defined like this. G star is just a normalized version of the energy density with an overall temperature dependence and a prefactor pulled out. That definition is convenient because you can easily compute G star by adding up the relativistic degrees of freedom, a factor of 7/8 for a fermion. So constructing this curve is, corresponds to counting degrees of freedom in the standard model. They go from G star equals 2 to G star equals 11/2 at a temperature of 0.5 MeV. And the 2 here is the photon, and the 11/2 is the electron and positron. And then I said, but I didn't go through and count, and I don't think I could without cheating and looking at some references. But you end up with some funny-looking shape like here, like this, where above the electroweak scale, if you count every degree of freedom in the standard model, you get a G star of around 106.75. Okay. And then, similarly, we talked about entropy density and showed how to compute it. And instead of talking about entropy density S, it's convenient to work with G star S, which is a normalized version of it. And at the level of counting degrees of freedom like this, G star and G star S are the same function of temperature. They differ when G star is constant. They're the same, but they're a little bit different. Like G star S is a little bit below G star in regions where transitions occur. Okay. And then the last thing you need to know, which is the hardest part to work out, is the connection between temperature, which is usually the more convenient time coordinate, and scale factor A, which you sometimes do need to know. And that relation is given by entropy conservation. In the sense that SA cubed is a constant. S is the entropy per unit physical volume. And so if the physical volume of the universe is increasing as A cubed, then the total entropy is S times A cubed. Or we use the G star S notation, the combination G star S B cubed A cubed. Is constant. So T goes almost as 1 over A, but not quite. This conservation law is the same thing as saying that E goes as 1 over E is a constant times 1 over G star S to the 1/3 times A. And so, in particular, I'll zoom in on this picture. I'll zoom in on E plus E minus annihilation and plot the temperature as a function of scale factor. And I want to pretend that this blackboard plot is a log-log plot so that E being proportional to 1 over A just looks like this straight line. And what happens is that, since T is proportional to 1 over G star S to the 1/3, okay, that at the time of E plus E minus annihilation, G star increases from 11 halves to 2, but increases by a factor of 11 fourths, which means that the temperature has to climb by 11 fourths to the 1/3 to compensate. So in pictures, here's what's happening. I compare the solid curve is the actual temperature, and if I compare that to what I would get if I extrapolated T equals 1 over A forever, it's higher by a factor of 11 fourths to the 1/3. I'm going into all this detail about it because it has some really interesting observational consequences that we'll talk about today. That's the picture. And if you prefer formal arguments to pictures, then we could calculate it this way. If I start at temperature Ti at some initial scale factor Ai, and end at temperature Tf at some final scale factor Af, then entropy conservation would say that the combination G star A cubed T cubed is conserved. I'll set the initial value and the final value equal. And then solving for Tf, could write this as G star I over G star the 1/3 times AI over AI. And then G star I is 2 and Y G star I is 11 halves and G star F is 2. And I get this factor of 11 fourths to the 1/3 appearing in TF. And then what's left over here is the combination TIAI over AF is just what I would get if I had started at this point, AITI, and just extrapolated a 1 over A time dependence forever down to scale factor AF. Okay. So the reason that I bring this up is that while so far I pretended that the universe only contains three particles, the positron, the electron, and the photon. But in fact, the neutrinos are around during this time, and something interesting happens with the neutrinos. But to explain that part, I need to change topics for a bit and talk about neutrino decoupling. So I'll just leave this picture somewhere unerased and come back to it later. Okay, so neutrino decoupling will be our first example of a decoupling event. So the last time I stated, but didn't try to derive, that neutrinos decouple from the plasma at around 1 MeV. So I want to explain why that's true. Decoupling means that the interaction rate is much less than the Hubble rate. The expansion rate is the number of interactions per unit time for one neutrino. So this is true, then the neutrino is decoupled. And then on the opposite limit, the neutrino is thermal. So I want to explain why neutrinos rapidly go from thermal to decoupled at a temperature of around 1 MeV. You might notice, you might wonder in advance before I do the calculation how the answer could be anything other than the electroweak scale at 100 G. That appears to be the only relevant energy scale. Okay, so the one input from particle physics that I want to use is that some neutrinos couple. I'm not going to calculate diagrams or anything, but I'll occasionally draw diagrams and then say what you would get if you calculated. Neutrinos couple to the plasma through diagrams like this that exchange a Z boson. And the only particle physics input that I'm going to use is that the cross section for this process. For processes involving two input particles, the rate is usually expressed as a cross section. Is the electroweak scale, G Fermi squared, times an energy dependence that I'll write. This is going to be just the back of the envelope calculation that doesn't keep track of two pi's or anything. So I'll just write the overall energy dependence as like the temperature squared. It's roughly proportional to the square of the energies of the particles involved. And I should say that this is only like a leading term in powers of T over the electroweak scale. But it's an excellent approximation if you're well below the electroweak scale. Okay. So
Rick, is the Fermi's constant the equivalent to the fine structure constant? Because in these diagrams, when we have two vertices, we include square root of the fine constant structure for each vertex, so we should have. I don't know why the Fermi squared is there.
Oh yeah, yeah. Would G Fermi up to order one factors, G Fermi is like the alpha squared of the electroweak interaction. There's like one power of the gauge coupling in each vertex. Very roughly over the mass of the Z boson squared. And that factor appears because in this limit where the particle energies are much lower than the mass of the Z boson, the Z boson is like very off shell, so that its propagator is 1 over m squared. And then the reason why this is all appearing squared is because, so the amplitude, the quantum mechanical amplitude here is roughly one power of G Fermi.
up to order one factor. And then it's getting squared because in QFT you always square the amplitude to get the cross section. And then the overall factor of T squared just has to arise from dimensional analysis to end up with a cross section with you. Okay. Next, I want to explain how you go from a cross section, which is what the QFT calculation will give you, to an interaction rate, which is what we need to analyze decoupling. And at the level of this back of the envelope calculation, I just take the number density. I guess I should say this is the number density of electrons. If I'm calculating the number of interactions per neutrino per unit time, then it's the number density of the electrons that one neutrino interacts with that matters. Times a cross section times like a typical relative velocity between the neutrinos and the electrons. I just offer the following hand waving argument. If you had a bunch of electrons at rest with some energy density NE, and then I fired in a single neutrino with some relative velocity V, then the number of interactions per unit time would be exactly N sigma V. And that's just like the definition of the cross spectrum of the cross section. There's a more exact formula where you integrate over if the relative velocity isn't the same for every pair of particles, but has some thermal distribution that you integrate over, and the cross section has velocity dependence, then this would be replaced by some sort of appropriate average over pairs of particles. But I'm just going to take, this is just an order of magnitude calculation. So I'm just going to, let me leave an empty box for the NE. And then I'll put in, for the sigma, I'll put the Fermi squared times the temperature squared. And for the velocity, I'll put 1. The neutrinos are very relativistic since their masses are tiny and it's all happening at MeV scales. Now for the NE, so I want to write this. I have to admit that I'm a little just realized that I forgot to check exactly which formulas Neil put up on the box. So if we were calculating I'll come back to NE in a minute. But if we were calculating the energy density of electrons, then we would do an integral like this. Okay. So I just want to say that for number density, this factor of E would become a 1. If you're counting particles per unit volume rather than figuring out the amount of the energy, the amount of energy per unit. Okay. And we're going to be interested in this in the relativistic limit, where the temperature is larger than the electron mass. And then you can do, for rho e, we expanded this out and got the factor of pi squared over 30, or 7/8 times pi squared over 30 for a fermion. For NE, you can do a very similar calculation and get this. There's just you'll get to experience on the homework the joy of doing a calculation very similar to this one. Maybe I'll write it as 3g over 4. G equals 2 for the electron. And then at the level of this back of the envelope calculation, I'm just going to write that as t cubed. I finished calculating the interaction rate. And as the universe cools and expands, we see that the interaction rate drops very quickly due to this factor of t cubed in the density of scatterers, and then an additional factor of t squared in the actual interaction cost. Okay. And now I want to compare that to the Hubble rate. So I'll calculate that at tilde level. So I relate the Hubble rate to the temperature. I'll start with Friedmann's equation. And then, in particle physics contexts where the gravitational constant appears, I like to replace it by 1 over m Planck squared. So I'm defining m Planck to be 8 pi g to the minus 1 half, which is around 10 to the 18 GeV. And then for the total energy of the universe, I'd like an expression involving the temperature. So I'll just write that as e to the fourth with this, or more precisely, pi squared over 30 times g star times e to the fourth. So then sweeping up all the order one constants into the tilde, the final result is t squared over m Planck squared. Sorry, t squared over 1 power of m Planck. So because the interaction strength of this weak interaction is growing faster with the temperature than the Hubble rate, it's going as t to the fifth, whereas the Hubble rate goes as t squared. The interaction is going to freeze out rather than freeze in. It'll be thermal at high temperatures and decoupled at low temperatures. And the condition for decoupling that better does lambda over h equal to 1, where lambda is Fermi squared t star to the fifth, and h is Planck to the minus 1 t star. Gives t star around Fermi to the minus 2 squared. Which is indeed around 1 MeV. So the reason we ended up with a scale other than the electroweak scale is because the Planck scale snuck into the calculation via Friedmann's equation. So this turns out to be, now unfortunately I need to cheat here. I'm trying to get away with doing calculations at tilde level rather than like putting in rates, which makes the equations so complicated they take forever to write down, and then you have to integrate them on the computer anyway. So we didn't really like keep track of the two pi's here. So we have no way of knowing whether the answer is really 1 MeV or 0.2 MeV, say. And it happens to be the case that the real number that you get is around 0.0 MeV, and that the decoupling is very rapid. And that's important because we really need to compare this to the temperature of E plus C minus annihilation at 0.5 MeV. It's important that neutrino decoupling, for what I'm going to say next, it's important that neutrino decoupling happened first. But we didn't really show that. I think we just showed that they happen around the same time. Okay, so I'm going to cheat a little bit. Taking this 1 MeV more seriously than I really have any right to. Okay. Now the next question I want to ask is what happens to the neutrinos after decoupling? Or rather, or more precisely, what happens to their mean occupation number? Let me write it off. As sort of a back of the envelope, to get a back of the envelope understanding without computing rates, let's assume decoupling is instantaneous. At a decoupling temperature T star. At decoupling, the distribution is thermal. At scale factor A star, the distribution is thermal at temperature T star, where I've written Q here. It'll be convenient to write Q instead of EQ, since the neutrinos are very non-relativistic, very relativistic. And then you'll recall that last time we argued that once a species decouples, it's mean occupation number at later times is just given by redshifting momentum. We had this general identity, and we showed that it formally solved Boltzmann's equation with zero collision term. But after decoupling, this occupation number is given by evaluating the mean occupation number at the earlier scale factor A star. But with momenta, you want to go back in time, so you want to blue shift momenta by multiplying by A. So then, plugging in, I get the expression for the mean occupation number of neutrinos at any time in the universe's history. I'll write as in more than one line.
The AQ over A-star. Or 1 over e to the q over t nu plus 1,
where I've defined the neutrino temperature I'm going to put temperature in quotes. I put temperature in quotes since I'm using a quantity with, I'm defining a quantity with units of temperature to describe a non-thermal distribution. So this distribution is non-thermal for two reasons. One is that Q appears here instead of E sub Q. And it sort of looks like a typo. But what it says is that the two differ when the temperature eventually becomes lower than the neutrino mass. And then it says that what will happen is that rather than the neutrinos annihilating, as would happen if they were in interacting with, still coupled to a thermal plasma, what will happen is that the number of neutrino particles will be conserved.
The number would be conserved. How
do
we see that?
Oh, yeah, I didn't really, so that that's not obvious just from staring at this expression. Okay. It I sort of jumped to saying that just based on the physical intuition that like what this expression means is that particles are just streaming on FRWGS6 without being created or destroyed. But if you wanted to prove that, you could. Let me write the number. Let me go back to the integral that I wrote down before.
Yeah, this one.
And let's see, rather than plugging in the neutrino distribution in this form, we'll plug it in this form. That's a great question to ask. I do these kinds of little checks all the time when I'm trying to understand physics, just to make sure that everything's consistent. And then you'll see that if I change variables to q prime equals aq, that I get out a factor of a to the minus. And the point of this expression is just that the there's no longer any a dependence. This integral is constant in a. So that the number density just goes as a to the minus 3, as you would expect in an expanding universe if particles are neither being created nor destroyed. You can also see in this expression that I was going to say this later in the lecture. If you now ask what happens to the energy density, then the energy density of a thermal particle would go as a to the minus 4 until the temperature reaches the rest mass, and then it starts to exponentially decrease because of annihilation. And what will happen here is that you it starts to go as a to the minus 3. That's not like as easy to show, but I leave it to you to think about why if you put an EQ here, you get this behavior. And this is what we expect at the beginning of the class when we were talking about stress energy and the behavior of the density in an expanding universe. We said that relativistic particles had W equals 1/3 and their energy density went as a to the minus 4. And a non-relativistic species satisfied W equals 0 and an a to the minus 3 scale. And that consistency check is satisfied here. So I wanted to say that there were two differences. So this is not a thermal distribution. Neutrinos are not thermal in the after decoupling. They're not thermal for two reasons, and this is one of the two reasons. They behave differently after the temperature falls below the rest mass. They start behaving as matter with a conserved number density. And then the other difference is that the temperature of the neutrinos always goes as 1 over a. It does not participate in this. It would not get, for example, this factor of 11/4. The plasma experiences during E plus E minus annihilation, not coupled to the plasma. So both of these statements, both the statement that the temperature always goes as 1 over A, regardless of what the plasma is doing, and the different behavior once the temperature falls below the rest mass, have some super interesting observational consequences, and so I want to talk about those. Okay. As I mentioned once before, I'm more of a data person, so I get really excited when I get to talk about the experiments. Okay. So going back to this plot, the solid curve shows what the temperature of the plasma is doing. This would continue all the way to today, where we observe the solid curve as the temperature of the CMB. The dashed curve here has a physical meaning. It's the temperature of the neutrinos. The temperature of the neutrino temperature is just what you would get if you started back here at the time when the neutrinos were not decoupled. And so the neutrino temperature is the same as everything else. And then just extrapolated a 1 over A forever.
all the way to today, where we experience T nu as the temperature of the CNB, or cosmic neutrino background. And so this 11/4 to this funny factor of 11/4 to the 1/3 does have an observational consequence. It predicts that we can predict the existence of a cosmic neutrino background whose temperature is has this very with a very sharp prediction for the temperature. The temperature should be 4/11 to the 1/3 times the CMB temperature. The CMB temperature is something that is very well measured. It's 2.726 Kelvin. So this works out to a number around 1.95 Kelvin today. Is it possible to verify this prediction? The answer is yes, if you're willing to be sufficiently indirect about what verification means. So the CNB has not been directly detected. There is like a long-running collaboration, which is the Ptolemy collaboration, which is trying to build new detectors that can detect the CNB. It's just super challenging because these are neutrinos are hard to detect, period. And these are very low energy neutrinos around a millielectron volt. The effect of this bath of neutrinos turns out to have a very large effect on the formation of the CMB at high redshift. So we can indirectly observe the CNB in the CMB. At hand waving level, you know, if the CNB is a small fraction of the energy density today, but if we go back to when the universe is radiation dominated, then the CNB density is comparable to the CMB density. It's an order one contribution to the energy density. And so during the time when the CMB is being formed, there's some complicated plasma physics where you evolve a bunch of perturbations in all of the species of the universe. The gravitational perturbations in the CNB just turn out to have a large effect. So large, in fact. So that was pretty hand-wavy. But I just wanted to give some idea of where this constraint came from. The observational constraint, the existence of the CNB can be measured at many sigma in the CMB. One way to say it is if there were no CNB, you would calculate like completely the wrong power spectrum of the CMB. And in fact, the measurement is so good that the temperature is known to about 1.5%. So I think that this is the one sigma error from modern CMB measurements, plus the detail. But you have to throw in some baryon acoustic data from galaxies at low redshift to break some accidental parameter degeneracy. I think this is a totally amazing intersection between theory and experiment. You go through this whole argument about what must be happening at MeV energy scales in a plasma, and you make this prediction. And then it's like perfectly verified. I'm going to come back shortly and I'll talk about this in like a little more detail. I also want to talk a little bit about neutrino mass. So as you guys anticipated with your questions, the non-thermalness of the neutrino of the CNB means that the CNB behaves as matter at late times. One way of thinking about this is that the number density of the
CNB neutrinos within an order one factor is the same as the number density of the CMB photons. And so a small neutrino mass gives the CNB a large energy density. Here's something that you'll show in your problem set. But the energy density of neutrinos today expressed as a fraction of the total energy density, which we know from measuring the Hubble expansion rate, is the sum of the three neutrino masses over 42 electron volts. In other words, if each neutrino had a mass as low as 10 electron volts, it would have an order one effect on the expansion of the universe. It would be a huge cosmological signal. So generally speaking, we're sensitive in cosmology nowadays to like percent level effects. Like if you change the expansion history by a percent, that's something that's measurable. And so you might guess that the constraint on the neutrino masses would be of order a tenth of an electron volt. That is what you get, the current upper limit, around 120 milli electron volts. I just wrote this down this equation just to explain a little bit why cosmology is so sensitive to the overall neutrino mass scale. This is the 95% confidence limit from combining. This is a global analysis that combines many different kinds of cosmological data. I want to put this measurement in context a little bit by talking about the situation in particle physics with neutrino masses. Let's see. So first I want to say that we know from neutrino oscillation experiments that neutrinos have mass. The neutrino oscillation experiments measure the squared mass differences between species. There's one mass splitting, which is order 9 millielectron volts. Another mass splitting, which is of order 50 millielectron volts. It's currently an open question whether I labeled the mass splittings with labels like 2-1 and 3-1 rather than things like electron neutrino and muon neutrino, because it's currently not known what order they go in. There are two possibilities that are allowed. There's the so-called normal hierarchy, where the lowest two mass neutrinos have the small splitting. We don't know the overall neutrino mass scale or the mass of the lightest neutrino. And then the particle data still allows the so-called inverted hierarchy. Where you put make M3 the lightest one. One thing that's really nice is how complementary particle physics and cosmology are here. Particle physics is sensitive to mass differences, or more properly, mass squared differences, with almost no sensitivity to the overall mass scale. And cosmology is the opposite. It measures the overall mass scale, or the sum of the neutrino masses, with no sensitivity to the individual mass. From these numbers, you can see that in the normal hierarchy, the sum of the neutrino masses is guaranteed to be greater than around 50 millielectron volts. And in the inverted hierarchy, it must be greater than number around 100 millielectron volts, which is quite close to the upper limit from cosmology. This upper limit will get better in the, I would guess, within 5 or 10 years. It could be down by factor of 5 or maybe 10. So these guaranteed signals are coming into view. And cosmology, well, if the overall mass scale is low enough, could rule out the inverted hierarchy and give an overall measurement of the neutrino mass. So this is one really interesting thing that's going to happen in observational cosmology in the near future. Okay. Now, we go back to the TCNB measurement and just elaborate on that a little bit more. This next topic I can't quite finish in 10 minutes, but I'll start it. This measurement that I quoted for the CNB temperature is not really a standard thing that you'll find in the literature. I'll tell you, I derived it in a minute. What you will see in the literature, like if you go to the Planck CMB results papers, you'll find this result. I'm just going to write it down first and then explain what it means. A constraint on the effective number of neutrino species. Okay, now I kind of dislike this terminology because there is a well-defined parameter, like this ineffective has a well-defined meaning, but it doesn't really have anything to do with neutrinos specifically. What it really is a weird parameterization of what I'll call rho relic, which is the energy density of decoupled relativistic species. At a temperature of around 1 eV when the CMB is being formed. And then the parameterization of rho relic that's being used is right, it defined this parameter ineffective by putting in the following weird string of numbers. This is the definition of ineffective. And it's defined so that a relic with a non-thermal distribution would contribute, basically normalized to give one for a neutrino, for a standard model neutrino. Just to write this out. Where T0 is Let me just write TCNB here, that's clear. Okay. So that each of the three standard model neutrinos, fermions with G equals 2, contribute one. I think this is kind of an unfortunate definition. It's a little bit more convoluted than it needs to be. Become the standard way to quote the cosmology constraint on decoupled relativistic stress energy in the early universe. Now, as is often the case, you can translate this. There's one, you know, thing that's being measured, and you can sort of interpret it differently depending on your assumptions. So here's a table of situations where you might, be interested in. There are three different ways that three physicists might choose to use this constraint. If I assume that the number of standard model neutrinos is a free parameter, but that the CNB temperature has its standard model values, and that there are no additional relics or decoupled relativistic species, then I'm sort of using the parameterization the way that was intended, and you can just read off the answer. If I were to assume three species, but that I don't know their temperature, I'm going to let that be a free parameter. But I'll assume no additional relics. Then I did a little algebra before the lecture and translated the ineffective constraint to the CNB constraint, temperature constraint that I quoted a few blackboards ago. And I think the most interesting way that you might choose to interpret this measurement is to say, well, we know that we understand the standard model at MEV scales pretty well. So let's just say we're comfortable assuming three standard model neutrinos and that the CNB temperature is 1.95 Kelvin. Interpret this as a measurement of
additional relics.
Whether there are additional like neutrino-like relics that froze out in the early universe. So for example, if a relic which decouples when we worked out the neutrino temperature, the only thing that really mattered is that the neutrino decoupled before electron positron annihilation, but after the previous annihilation event, which is muon annihilation at 100 MeV. That would contribute basically by the same analysis. Would be ruled out. The smallest ineffective you can get is 4/7 for a scalar. And that's ruled out at more than 3 sigma by the current measurement. Relics at higher decoupling temperatures are allowed within the current error bars. Like to take the other extreme, a relic which decouples at a temperature, at a very high temperature, anything above 100 GeV, where the standard model G star is 106.7, 6.75. By an analysis similar to our analysis of the neutrino temperature, I worked out before class and would be a nice homework problem, although I didn't think to assign it. Something like this could be hiding in the CMB, like a scalar. I guess it is the spot. But like a scalar or a boson with G equals zero would contribute about 0.03 to ineffective, which is, you know, like a 0.2 sigma shift. You could hide, you know, maybe 10 or so spin degrees of freedom at these very high temperatures while still evading the CMB constraint. But there's a lot of room to make the CMB constraint better. It can get better. This error bar can get better by a factor of, you know, 10 or so with futuristic experiments. And so, you know, another, and it's nice to have this natural target. Like if we could get down to the level of ruling out contributions to ineffective at this level, then we would rule out the presence of light relics all the way through the range of energies covered by the standard model. Out to some very high energy, like at some sufficiently high energy, the standard model breaks down and the G star would start to go up again. And we don't know exactly where that is. But we would have the ability in cosmology to look back to very, very high energy scales.
So to rule out something, we would have to, that thing has to be greater than the error bar or something like that, right?
Yeah, right. And, you know, you really want the error bar to be, this is the one sigma error bar. You really want the error bar to be like a factor of, you know, at least 3 less than the actual value. Okay. So that's all I have to say about neutrinos. Next time I'll talk about dark matter. Are there any questions before we okay.